This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
When you need a bit of inspiration to spice up your outfit for that perfect hashtag OOTD, that's outfit of the day, by the way, for those of you who don't speak hashtags, one of your options would be to flip through a fashion magazine. Vogue, InStyle, Allure, Elle. These are just some of the top fashion magazines out there right now. Pages and pages of glossy, beautiful pages to give you inspirations, as well as articles on tips and tricks and hacks. It's hard to argue against the fact fashion publications play such an important role in defining trends and helping you find hidden gems.
With such a big role to play in the fashion society, fashion journalists have a different but equally interesting task on their hands. And it comes with its own sets of challenges and perceptions, especially if they work for a hard copy magazine publication.
BFM 89.9, good morning, I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Baharuddin.
This is In Case You Missed It. This week, we'll be exploring the world of fashion journalism.
But before that, we have a couple of stories from Asia Calling. India's surrogacy industry comes into question, and in Afghanistan, women are thriving in football.
Thousands of childless people from around the world have flocked to Indian surrogacy clinics over the years as a preferred destination for surrogacy. However, the central government has recently banned foreigners from hiring surrogate mothers. Critics of the law have called it a major setback to the country's rapidly growing surrogacy industry, but activists believe the practice of surrogacy exploits the rights of disadvantaged women. From New Delhi, Bismillah Gilani investigates both sides of the debate.
I think there is that element associated with it, yes, but I think that it's an incredibly huge thing to enter into.
India is one of the few countries where surrogacy is allowed, and over recent years, the country has become a popular destination for what some describe as made-to-order babies or rent-a-womb. For foreigners like David Ellis, a UK-based gay man, the country represents a chance to fulfill their wishes for children. David opted for surrogacy after his repeated attempts to adopt a child failed.
Obviously, being in a same-sex relationship, it's incredibly difficult to adopt. I think if I'd have been an American or US citizen, it's a lot easier to do that. And ultimately, I wanted to have a family of my own, and surrogacy ended up being the only route that I could take.
India has become known as the surrogacy capital of the world, with nearly 3,000 surrogacy homes across the country. But not anymore. The government has now imposed a ban on foreigners hiring surrogate mothers, and a proposed law is seeking to extend the ban to the entire commercial surrogacy industry, estimated to be worth more than $2 billion annually. The development has come as a major disappointment for some of India's surrogacy circles. For 28-year-old Shabnam, who is pregnant with her second surrogate child, it means a total loss of livelihood.
I came into it because my husband is handicapped and cannot work. I thought I would help others and solve my problems as well. The ban is totally unjustified. After all, we are not doing anything wrong. We are doing a service, and this is now our need. They should not ban it. They should not deprive us of the support.
Bajrang Singh opened a surrogacy home in suburban Delhi just a few years ago.
Our job is to search for surrogates and counsel them. We carry out all the investigation to ensure that they are fit to carry out a pregnancy. The idea basically was to give the surrogates proper nursing care and treatment during the pregnancy.
Singh says that as a new entrant to the industry, he will be okay, but the surrogate mothers will be the worst hit by the new ruling.
I am more worried about the surrogates because most of them are poor and come from slum areas. But with just one surrogacy, they earn more than what they can earn otherwise in a decade.
Dependent on surrogacy for a living, Shabnam and Singh are against the ban. But outlawing commercial surrogacy has been a long-pending demand of many women's groups, including the National Commission for Women. Chairperson Lalita Kumara Mangalam says surrogacy exploits poverty and violates the dignity of women.
There is no informed consent. The only reason they come into it is out of their poverty. So that's the only choice they have, if you look at it as a right to choice. As soon as the word commercial comes into the picture, the exploitation of the poor woman begins.
The surrogacy clinics or homes are often accused of underpaying the women and treating them as hostages during the 9 months of their pregnancy. In some cases, the commissioning parents have also abandoned babies born with birth defects. Experts say there are various ethical, social, and legal issues involved in surrogacy, but that an outright ban will only exacerbate the problem. Ranjana Kumari, director of the New Delhi-based Center for Social Research, says strict regulations and effective implementation would be a better solution.
We have from time to time pointed out various problems and suggested measures to set them right. A law that would have regulated the whole process, brought about transparency and ensured protection of the rights of everyone involved, has been pending for so many years. The government didn't move on that and now has come up with a ban, which is just a knee-jerk reaction. Banning is the worst we can do. It has never solved any problem.
As the ban goes into effect, others in India fear that the ban will only push couples into a surrogacy black market. From New Delhi, this is Bismillah Gilani for Asia Calling.
Hanif, I feel really conflicted. On one hand, I support the call to stop the exploitation of disadvantaged women, but on the other, I see the point made about how it provides the women with a source of income. The argument against it is that the clinics don't pay the surrogates enough money. So why can't mechanisms be put into place to ensure the surrogates are compensated adequately? I don't want to scream patriarchal society problems, but it strikes me as that. Men making rules to dictate something women do without the women who are part of it having a say.
I think that surrogacy is a very noble thing and should not be stopped. There should just be a better way to go about it.
Mm-hmm.
Women should be empowered to make their own choices, I agree. But when their choices are dictated by pure necessity, then is it still empowering? That's how the government of India is probably seeing the issue, especially since most of the women who became surrogate mothers are from poor families. And it is a bit uncomfortable to think of how the country has become an outsourced hub for foreign couples looking to have babies on the cheap.
I guess that's one way to look at it. But what about if, you know, you're a parent and you really want children, but you can't afford to have a surrogate in a, I don't know, Western country or something, and it's cheaper for you to have one in India?
Well, yeah, but I don't know, something about it doesn't sit right with me. Over recent years, more and more young Afghan women are taking up football, going against social norms. There are now hundreds of women players across the country and a key national team. Gayu Waziri meets them in the capital, Kabul.
Inside Kabul's Football Federation Stadium, dozens of Afghan women footballers are practicing their skills. Some of the players recently returned from a training camp in Japan. Zohra Mehri is the chief of the Afghan Women's Football Committee.
From 2006 up to now, the Afghan women's national football team has conducted several different trips abroad for training and matches. The team participated in the SAFF game in Bangladesh and also in Pakistan, and our team won third position in 2014.
Currently, more than 100 women football players are training in different clubs around Afghanistan. It is a huge jump. Several years ago, there were only a few female players in the whole country. 18-year-old Rahima has been playing football for 2 years now. She always dreamed of joining the national team, and now she is actually doing it.
When I saw other football players on TV, I hoped I could be a player like them one day. Then I found out Afghanistan had a women's football team and was looking for recruits, so I joined. I'm really happy now. Twice a week we train for more than 2 hours a day. I hope one day I can be the best female football player in Afghanistan.
In a conservative country like Afghanistan, it is not easy for women to play football. Many female players have stories of being threatened or criticized for being a woman that wants to play sport. 23-year-old university student Khatul Dawar, a former player and now trainer, admits there has been a lot of challenges.
When I started playing football in 2007, I faced a lot of social difficulties. Even when I traveled for training or matches abroad, my family kept my travel secret from our relatives. Sometimes I also received phone calls, people threatening me, saying that if I continued playing, they would target me with an explosion and kill me.
But Asadullah, a male player in the local league, Kabul, is very supportive of women players like Khatul.
I'm very happy to hear about these women who are interested in playing sport, especially football. I don't agree that women should just be at home doing housework. Women are playing sport not only in Afghanistan, but in other Islamic countries. It's very good that women here have the chance as well.
Officials from the Afghan Women's Football Federation say that despite the problems, they have had significant achievements over the past 3 years. Receiving an international referee card in recognition in the past year and the huge spike in the number of female players is a big win. Shaista Siddiqui, chief of the Women's Football Referees Association.
Fortunately, women's enthusiasm for football has really increased. Before, we could hardly find a woman to recruit to the team. Due to social problems and threats, most of the women and girls were not willing to join us, but now they come on their own.
Still, there are some barriers. Most of female players stop playing once they get married, but player Masuma Mohammadi says it doesn't have to be that way. After some convincing, her husband finally came around.
When I got engaged, my husband knew I was a football player. He told me up until when we got married that I could keep playing. Then after our marriage, when he found out how much I love playing football, I convinced him and he let me continue.
Captain of the national Afghan women's football team, Marina Aslamzada, says she is working hard to promote the sport across the country, such as open clubs over women who want to play football in provinces all over Afghanistan.
We have clubs for those who want to join us, and when they learn skills, then they can play in the Women's Football League. And from that league, we select the best players for the national team.
Across the country, Afghan women are kicking more and more goals. For Aisha Kaling, this is Ghair Waziri from Kabul, Afghanistan.
I'm very happy for the women in Afghanistan. The country seems to be moving in the right direction. Let's hope that they will do well in tournaments. On a side note, Cheryl, it is always interesting to see how women's involvement in sports has been garnering much attention, and for the right reasons as well.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed even some of the sports media websites that I frequent started covering women's football and displaying them at their front pages too. Even video games like FIFA 16 now has women teams in them. The shift is real, it seems.
I agree, Hanif. There seems to be more acceptance and inclusion when it comes to women in sports. And to see the kids change to suit religious beliefs is another big step towards inclusivity. Fun fact, the Afghan women's football team will also be the first to feature a kit which includes a built-in hijab, allowing players to be covered from head to toe when competing. Asia Calling was produced by Kanto Brita Radio Enam Lapan Ha in Jakarta. And after the break, we delve into the world of fashion journalism. Is it really like what we see in the movies like Devil Wears Prada?
All that in a minute.
I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Baharuddin.
This is In Case You Missed It. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is In Case You Missed It. I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Baharuddin.
Bill Cunningham, a famous fashion photographer, once said, "Fashion is the armor to survive the reality of everyday life." And it's difficult not to agree with him. See, when a woman looks at a closet and says she has nothing to wear, it doesn't really mean she literally has nothing to wear. Mostly it just means she has nothing to wear to portray who she wants to be today, the persona she wants to embody.
I see, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. That's the reason why I think fashion publications get so much traction among the fashion conscious. People turn to magazines like Elle, Vogue, and Clio to get their fashion fix. From the latest trends by esteemed designers and celebrities, to simple do-it-yourself fashion hacks to give your wardrobe that extra boost, fashion magazines are trusted to provide it all. Which is why fashion journalists have such a big role to play. They help communicate trends and translate them from catwalk to the sidewalk. Sounds like a glamorous job, like what we see in the movies. Or is it?
Kate Guest is the editor-in-chief of Elle Magazine Malaysia. I spoke to her to get an insight into that specific question, among other things. I started off by asking her what fashion journalism means to her.
Fashion journalism is really dependent on the medium, I think. So fashion journalism in a magazine is very different to fashion journalism in a newspaper or on a website. And then within that, it's such a huge genre, so it can take in everything from reviews of runway shows to interviews with designers to profile pieces to critical pieces. So it's a really broad genre.
And how does Elle Malaysia separate itself from, say, other fashion magazines in Malaysia?
Myself and the women that work on Elle and our readers, we know that they're interested in politics, that they're interested in their careers, they're interested in financial success, they're interested in travel, they love looking after their homes, they're interested in interior decorating. I mean, women have so many different interests. And I think Elle has always been focused on addressing that. And I think sometimes, you know, people kind of look at fashion and people who are interested in fashion as being superficial. And we've always taken the kind of opposite stance to that. We kind of view fashion for women in the same way that men might view sport. It's fun, it's great to have an interest in it, but it's just one part of a really varied, full, whole life.
Exactly, and it doesn't define you. For instance, like a man who likes sports can also talk about politics, so why?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I think that we're very conscious of that double standard at Elle. Elle is always also very pro-woman. So in Malaysia, we're quite a new magazine. We've only just had our two-year anniversary. But this social support for women is something that we're looking into now, and we're hoping to get that up and rolling this year.
Would Elle Magazine Malaysia consider its content to be somewhat feminist?
I mean, definitely, yes. I'm a feminist, and, you know, I think most of the women on our team would identify themselves as feminist. And I think there is still a little bit of reluctance around using that F word. But, you know, for the magazine itself, a magazine is always the product of the people on the team. So yes, on the website, for instance, we're never going to talk about women flaunting their curves. We're never going to do stories about celebrities with no makeup, or, you know, we're never going to criticize a woman's body. So yes, I would say we definitely take a very pro-women approach. Yeah. And I know that a lot of people would take issue with a fashion magazine calling itself feminist.
Yes, that's the thing.
Yeah.
A lot of people would be like, well, actually, no, because fashion magazines portray a certain type of woman.
Aesthetic. Yeah. Absolutely. I'm really conscious of that. The body size issue is a huge one in the fashion industry. And obviously, fashion magazines are part of that. And we do have a responsibility to portray women who look healthy. And we have definitely said no to fashion spreads or models who we think are not healthy. But in some ways, you know, a fashion magazine in Malaysia is just a very, very small player in the industry. And it starts from the fashion designer's vision, really, for their collection. The woman that they see wearing it. I mean, fashion designers love to work with the same models over and over again. So, you know, some have a specific woman in mind when they're designing their collections. you know, and then it follows through to the casting of their shows, the models that they choose. So I would say that we do as much as we can to choose healthy representations of women, but of course there's still a long way to go. Again, this is something that I feel like we've started having more of a discussion and more of a dialogue about in recent years,
yeah,
with models like Rob.
Yeah.
There is a fantasy element in it, but on the other hand, I don't think we should be creating that fantasy as the ideal.
All right, and so how long have you been in the fashion journalism industry?
So I've been working in magazines for about 12 years now, but I wouldn't say that I come from a fashion background. I've worked for big international fashion titles in Australia and, of course, now here as well. But I started out in newspapers, then I worked for a glossy monthly title in Melbourne, which covered everything from fashion to watches and jewellery to lifestyle to politics, current affairs. And then I was working in a food magazine when I was in London for the last 2 years before I left. And now I've been in Malaysia for 3.5 years, and I joined Elle before it launched. So I was deputy editor from the time it launched, and I became editor-in-chief last June.
What has been the highlight of your career in Elle Malaysia?
It's hard. I wouldn't choose one issue as a highlight, because you never produce the perfect magazine issue. You always look at it afterwards and think, I wish we could have done this, or I wish we'd done that story in a different way. I'm really proud of the story we had in our launch issue, which was a group of Malaysian women talking about the state of the nation for women in Malaysia. I really loved that story. On the website, we've done some really great stuff. I'm really, really proud of an opinion piece that we published, which was a response to Ridwan T's comments about women and rape, which were just outrageous. We asked a rape survivor to write this piece for us, and she did an incredible job, and it got loads of coverage, and I'm really proud that Elle was the magazine, the title, the website that did that. In terms of the magazine, we have beautiful fashion spreads every month that I'm always really proud of. I think it's not a highlight as such, but I think I would just say that I'm proud of the direction that we're heading. I'm proud that we are very pro-women and we are supportive of women, and that we can kind of do that in the fashion magazine genre, because it's quite difficult to do that sometimes.
Let's talk about your audience. What is Elle Magazine's demographic like?
We did a reader survey last year, and we found that most of our readers are urban professionals, relatively high earning, living in the KL area. And the age range is quite broad, but 21 to 40 is definitely the majority. I would say our average reader is a 30-year-old woman living in KL, working in a white-collar job. On the website, judging from the content that they love and look at again and again, we can see that our audience is a little bit younger on the website. So that's great. That means that we kind of hook new readers in through the website, and then we hope that we will introduce them to the magazine through the website and Instagram and social media, and then that they will go on to buy the magazine. So we have a pretty broad demographic of about 20 years, I would say.
And what about the audience psychographic, i.e. lifestyle, personalities, interests?
She has a great interest in fashion, well, we know that. But she's also very much a traveller. From our reader survey, we found that most of our readers are travelling at least twice a year. So the fact that she's travelling so much, it also gives her access to so many other interesting things. Like, you know, she's discovering new designers, new hotels and resorts, and what street style is like in other cities. So all of that we have to really take into account, and we can't be kind of showing her something as if she's never seen it before. I think back in the pre-internet days, it was quite easy for magazines to be a little bit preachy and kind of present things as this is the authoritative version of something. These days it's a lot harder to do that, because people have so much access through traveling and through the internet. So I'm very conscious of not talking down to readers. Our reader is definitely well informed.
And what is Elle Magazine's circulation like?
That I can't really tell you about. We keep that under wraps.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a little bit tricky in Malaysia to get accurate circulation figures. So yeah, we keep ours in-house.
Let's talk about the content of the magazine then. Can you describe to us a template of what you can typically find in a fashion magazine?
I can tell you what you can find in Elle. Elle is an international brand with 46 editions around the world. It gives us great access to incredible content from all of those editions. Obviously, we mainly take the content from the English language editions, but we have also taken content from Elle China, for instance, Elle Hong Kong. In Malaysia, we aim to have about 70% local content and 30% we pick up from international editions. And our sections focus on, obviously, fashion. At the front of the book, we have a radar section, which is basically our pick of the trends to know about that month. We have a style section, which is kind of shopping-focused pages. We have an agenda section, which is where we have our journalism, basically. In celebrity interviews, relationships, career stories, that kind of thing. Then we have the Fashion Well, which every fashion magazine has, and that's just our fashion spreads. No text and full bleed, beautiful images. And then we obviously have a beauty section, which is definitely our second pillar after fashion. We have a really strong beauty section, which is full of features on everything from fitness to well-being to food. We've done a few tweaks lately, so we have a regular Our Fit Club page, that kind of thing. Yeah, fashion is definitely our focus, but beauty is also really, really important for Our. And then finally, we have a living section. I guess that kind of sums up the holistic approach we take to creating content for women.
And when is the magazine's busy period?
But the biggest issues of the year for any magazine will be the March issue and the September issue, because that's officially the start of the new season, spring, summer or autumn, winter. Though I have to say that we do start showing content from those new seasons in February, sometimes in January issues. So they're definitely the biggest issues, and then April and October would probably be the second biggest issues.
So now, looking at trends, since you've already mentioned that you have publications all over the world and you would pick and choose from those, how do you contextualise trends or content from your overseas publications? Because Malaysia's cultural and fashion makeup is different from what you may find in Europe or North America.
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't say that the trends here are so different as they are in other countries in terms of seasonal trends. Every country will do a collections report that rounds up the biggest trends that they've seen on the runways that year. So, you know, this season it's stripes and there was a lot of denim, and for instance. But it's the way that you choose to interpret the trend, I guess. We might think that Malaysia's market is a little more interested in glamour, for instance, than, say, the Australian market. It may not be as raunchy as the French market or the Italian market. So, yeah, it's more in the way that we choose to style the trends and represent the trends. And then, of course, it affects hair and makeup and all of that, those kind of things. But, you know, again, I would come back to the fact that the world is so international today. Our readers are so savvy and so aware of what's going on in the rest of the world that I think those kind of national differences are becoming less and less important.
Let's move on to sustainability. Mm-hmm. Are fashion magazines sustainable in Malaysia, meaning the hard copy version of it? Or do you find that your readers are moving towards the digital version of your magazine?
I know that people love to say that print is dead. It's a great headline, it sounds great, but it's really not true. I think, you know, there's no denying the fact that magazines have gone through a tough 10 years, that print sales have definitely declined. But for me, we're a young magazine. Mongoose Publishing chose to launch this magazine just 2 years ago. If they were worried about the future of print, they wouldn't have launched Al in Malaysia at that time. But it did affect the strategy that we had. So we launched our website first. We launched a website in January and then the magazine followed in March. And we have very much been focused on being a digital-first publication. So we have three writers who are on our website, and that's more than any other magazine in Malaysia has. And we've always been very focused on delivering a really strong digital platform. But print is like the premium, the luxury product. You know, you can't get the same impact from a beautiful fashion shot when you're looking at it on your mobile phone as you can when you turn the page and it kind of hits you in the face, this gorgeous colour and feeling of luxury that you just can't get through pixels. But, you know, having said that, magazines have definitely needed to up their game in terms of digital, and I think in Malaysia most have been quite slow to do that.
And like you said, the difference between having a magazine in your hand versus looking at it through your phone, there's a certain like, I've read Elle magazine in its magazine form versus other magazines on the mobile phone, and there's that difference, like you said, it, you feel more glamorous. It's a feeling that you get as well. So you're not just buying content, you're also It's
a feeling, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love the website for how fast it is, how quickly we can respond to news, and how fun it is. Like I said, I don't know if it's just because we have younger readers, but we definitely have a more playful, fun, take the mickey approach on the website. We definitely muck around a lot more on the website. Whereas the print product is a little bit older, definitely more sophisticated, definitely more of a luxury high-end product that we want to kind of showcase the most beautiful fashion, the best content, the best journalism in the world. So that medium is made for the content that we produce for it. They are quite different products, but, you know, they're complementary, and it still all needs to feel like Elle.
Let's move on to the ethics of it then. How do fashion journalists negotiate between reporting honest opinions on fashion, you know, meaning trends that maybe don't translate from beyond the catwalk, and working with designers and brands that are selling products that may not work for the average person? How do you negotiate that?
So I think, coming back to fashion journalism, good fashion journalism is just good journalism. The best fashion journalists would be great journalists no matter what genre they were working in. They've got all the elements that make up a great journalist. You know, they're great reporters, they're great researchers, they have huge natural curiosity. All of those things that make journalists great, no matter what area they're working in, are what make fashion journalists great. A key part of that is objectivity. And I think the best fashion critics are those who work either for newspapers or websites. Fashion magazines don't publish criticism as such. We don't really do show reviews. Our content is, you know, long read journalism or profiles or interviews with designers or stories about heritage and artistry of the brand, things like that. But, you know, that said, if something makes it into the pages of Elle, then it's obviously an endorsement by Elle. I guess people like to say that, you know, fashion magazines criticize by leaving something out, as in they just don't say anything about it. And I guess that is true, though, you know, it's not that we're beyond saying something, you know, something hasn't worked or we think it could have been done better. It's not that we're beyond saying that, but you won't find kind of that kind of vociferous criticism in a fashion magazine that you might find from someone writing for a newspaper. The two are very different styles of fashion journalism. And obviously, fashion magazines don't make their profits from their cover price. They make their profits from the advertisers that take up advertising space in the magazine. And we're a business. There's no denying that we have to nurture our relationships with our advertisers. Does that mean that we write gushing reviews of all the shows that they do because they're an advertiser? No, never. It doesn't. But does it mean that we focus our spotlight on the people that support the magazine? Yeah, the answer is yes, and every single magazine will do that.
People liken working for a fashion magazine to what they see in movies, you know, like that in Devil Wears Prada, for example. Is it really as glamorous and as cutthroat as that?
Oh my God, I wish I had her wardrobe.
Me too.
Yeah, Miranda Priestly's wardrobe. I think it can be as glamorous as you make it, and it kind of depends on the person. I mean, like I said, I don't come from a fashion background. I come from a journalism background, and I've just happened to have worked in magazines for a long time, and I love magazines. It's not my style to kind of be that kind of editor, but I think there are definitely editors who are like that, who are known for being like that. So in some ways, I think that portrayal is true. I think it's more of a true portrayal for magazines in, you know, big markets like New York or London. Here in Malaysia, I don't think people are as Miranda Priestly. You just can't get away with it, really, I think. In terms of glamour, yeah, it can be really glamorous. It's not so glamorous when you're kind of sitting at your desk at 11 o'clock at night eating pot noodles and, you know, signing off pages. But, yeah, sitting front row at Dior in Paris is glamorous, and having dinner at the home of Louis Vuitton is glamorous. So, yeah, there are definitely moments of glamour, at least.
And what advice do you have for people who are keen to get a job as a fashion journalist?
You need to decide whether you're a writer or a stylist if you want to work on the fashion side of things. Because in most countries, they're two very different paths. You're a great writer and you're interested in writing about fashion, or you love putting looks together. You love styling people. in which case you go down the fashion editor route. However, in Malaysia, it's a little bit different because our teams are so small. The fashion editor really has to wear both hats. So they will be writing and they will be styling shoots as well.
All right. Thank you so much, Kate, for agreeing to be interviewed.
Great. Okay. That was fun.
That was Kate Guest, Editor-in-Chief of Elle Magazine Malaysia. This morning's show was produced by my co-producer Hanif Baharudin and me, Cheryl Koh.
I hope it's been food for thought. And remember, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance.
This is, in case you missed it, BFM 89.9,
The Business Station. Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.